Okay, and so we continue this series of four lectures on C.G. Jung, a portrait of a 20th century wizard. And tonight I'd like to address the subject of Jung and the tradition of vision. In the little Swiss village of Kesweil, along the Rhine River, there is a commemorative plaque upon a small, old stone house. It says, "In this house was born C.G. Jung, July 26, 1875 to June 6, 1961. Explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths." For over a decade now, I've been teaching and lecturing about Jung, attempting to share with others some of the bounty bequeathed us in the legacy of this man, this most remarkable individual, this explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths. And over those many years, I've witnessed a variety of responses to these efforts, both, in my own personal associations, and also responses to Jung in the broader matrix of our culture. In my own personal efforts, I have occasionally seen a sudden twinkle in the eye, a glimmering of comprehension come. And perhaps all too many times, as I've rambled on about this subject, I've seen a glaze of boredom. And sometimes both in series. It depends on how long you ramble on about some of these things. But it's become apparent to me over the years here, though it was not at first so apparent to me, it's become apparent that most people have difficulty understanding Jung. Difficulty understanding his writing, which can seem quite obtuse and circular and locked up in ancient words, ideas, myths. They have difficulty understanding his system of psychology, what its real foundation is, how it works, what its sometimes seemingly obscure terminology means. And they have difficulty understanding him as a historical personage. The man is something of a puzzle. As I mentioned last week in reading the biography recently written by Deirdre Baer, often, as does she in her biography, one comes away from a study of Jung with a shopping bag full of puzzle pieces and no map, no key, no guide to the puzzle itself. So tonight I will, again, try to share some insights about this man, and again, give a hint, a key to the puzzle. But let me warn you, like in the stories of old, the magic key that unlocks this treasure is of a most subtle substance. It has its own magical nature. And even though one holds it up in plain view, there will be some who will see, and there will be some who see nothing. So what is story? What is history? In his 82nd year of life, Jung was persuaded, finally, to cooperate in the production of a biography of his story. He was extremely resistant to this whole project because in his own evaluation, most biographies, at least most autobiographies, were self-serving and generally of not much value. But as his life approached its end, he was finally persuaded. His terms were that he wouldn't write it, but he would submit to interviews. And his secretary, Anilia Yaffe was her name at that time, sat down with him on one appointed afternoon each week and enticed him to talk a bit about his life, to try to put together a coherent biography. As the interviews went on, Jung's resistance lessened, and all of a sudden something seemed to open in him, and he found a statement that he wished to make. The final result of that effort is a book we have today as Memories, Dreams, Reflections, entitled. The book is composed in half in the direct words of Jung, the thing that came out of these interviews, things that he felt motivated to write and to add. And in half, it is a recension of the interviews, the stories he told to Anilia Yaffe, all edited together. In the prologue to that autobiographical reflection, Jung presents his own key to the puzzle of his life. He starts with these words. My life is a story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation, and the personality, too, desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. I cannot employ the language of science to trace this process of growth in myself, for I cannot experience myself as a scientific problem. What we are to our inward vision, what man appears to be under the view of eternity, can only be expressed by way of myth. Myth is more individual and expresses life more precisely than does science. Science works with concepts of averages, which are far too general to do justice to the subjective variety of an individual life. Thus it is that I have now undertaken, in my 83rd year, to tell my personal myth. I can only make direct statements, only tell stories. Whether or not the stories are true is not the problem. The only question is whether what I tell is my fable, my truth. My fable, my truth. He says he's going to tell us a story. Well, most of us, when we approach a biography, we're looking for his story. We're looking for facts. What happened? What did he say? What did she say? What happened out here on this exterior plane of reality? I mean, isn't that a biography? We want truth. And Jung, at the very beginning of his own autobiographical enterprise, tells us he has no such facts to offer us. All he has are myths, stories, his myths, his stories. I think you have to approach that fact as a key to this man himself. In the first lecture of this series, I shared with you several myths, several stories from history, stories about wizards, stories, myths, born from the human imagination, ancient, modern. And while we certainly in history can find recorded stories, I think the key question we need to ask ourselves about history, about the history of any individual, a biography, is, is there a story that is history? What is the relationship of history and story? Is history itself a story? Is there a story being told in the history of cultures, of civilizations, of aeons? Is that story, that myth with meaning, found even in the singular fact of one human life? His, yours, mine. And history has struggled in the age of social sciences to find some solid grounding. History wants to be a science in this day and age. The realm of human knowledge, once called arts, has, of course, fallen totally out of favor. As any who have taken a degree in English or philosophy or arts probably knows, about the only thing it buys you in this world is a job at Barnes & Noble, working on the back shelves, not to depreciate that. But it doesn't bring in the lucre. It's science. Science gets you there. Business science. Social sciences. Psychological sciences. Knowing. Yeah? Well, history, you know, has a problem. Because all mixed up in this word history is story. And history's been struggling now for the last couple hundred years to get rid of that story part. Because, well, what are stories? The most subtle of substances. And perhaps in no fashion tied to truth. But what do you have left if you take the story out of history? You got one big hiss. That's my Zen koan, you know, for the evening. You know, you've all heard that the Zen koan. You know, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Okay, what is history without story? Contemplate that. We've got two words here mixed up in this problem. Fact and fiction. Fact comes from, in our language, an old Latin word, facere, to do. What was actually done. Fiction, fingere, to form, to mold. Now we're really interested in our unidimensional, in our singular vision, in the facts. But the problem is that it's very hard to tell a history without telling a story. And as we tell story, we start to fingere, to form, to mold, to pattern, to, with our internal vision and understanding, with our psychological, soulful perspective, to grant motive, and, importantly, to grant meaning. It is the imaginative inclination of humankind to bring to the fact, the act done of history, a forming, fictive story. Okay, so where does that story come from? If it wasn't in the fact, if it isn't intrinsic in the fact, where the hell is it coming from? Our imagination. Well, that's the problem with putting these fictions in with the facts. Because we're mixing up with something solid, something real. Imagination. A fiction. A lie. And that's what all stories are. We know that. They're fictions. They're lies. Aren't they? Or are they something more? That's the problem we have. And that's what Jung hits us in the face with at the beginning of his biography. This, ladies and gentlemen, is not all fact, exterior, unitary, linear. There's a fiction crossing this fact. And that's what he's concerned with. He's concerned with a story. In my own considerations, I for many years have been thinking of this as the problem of the fictive fact, the wedding of the imaginative meaning with life. Our social sciences, our knowings of this day, would have a history entirely devoid of its story. The problem is that history becomes absolutely meaningless. And there are scholars, who would have it just that, meaningless. A meaningless vector in time. And if that's how you see it, if that's how you see history, if that's how you find your own life, a meaningless part of a meaningless singular vector in a unidimensional space, if that's how you see it, then Jung will never, never, ever make sense to you. The story we'll make of any life, the story we'll make of any history, of any civilization, is a fiction, a thing that is really not, a lie. But that is not how Jung saw his life, nor the history of his people, of his civilization, of humankind. He goes on in the prologue. Life has always seemed to me like a plant that lives on its rhizome, its root. Its true life is invisible, hidden in the rhizome. The part that appears above ground lasts only a single summer. Then it withers away, an ephemeral apparition. When we think of the unending growth and decay of life and civilizations, we cannot escape the impression of absolute nullity. Yet I have never lost a sense of something that lives and endures underneath the eternal flux. What we see is the blossom, which passes. The rhizome, the root remains. In the end, the only events in my life worth telling are those when the imperishable world erupted into this transitory one. That is why I speak chiefly of inner experiences, amongst which I include my dreams and visions. These form the prima materia, the first matter of my scientific work. They were the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. Jung lived in the crossing of two realities. You must understand this to understand the man. A fictive and a factual. The act of time and the imposition of a rhizome, a root, that sank into a reality before, beyond, other than time and space. In the vision of Jung, human life was wed to a story. Our history was the manifestation of a story. His life, his myth, was a manifestation of a fact and a fiction. Jung was born in 1875. The son of a poor parson, born to, nonetheless, a respectable family. His father, a parson, as were, I believe, eight or so of his associated uncles and relatives. His great-grandfather had been a very prominent physician, whose name also was Carl Gustav Jung. In fact, it is part of the history of this family, the legend of the family, that Jung's grandfather, after whom he was named, was actually the illegitimate adulterous son of Goethe, the author of Faust. Well, it's probably not true. Jung went looking for the facts behind that fiction and never found them. Could never put his grandmother and Goethe together at the right time. But, well, it was a story that he dealt with. Early in his childhood, and throughout his youth, Jung's experience of life was marked by an intense inner experience. What he came to see, what he came to call within the vocabulary that was given him, as an experience, a natural experience of God. It was the only term he could use to express the fact that touched him. He had early dreams. He lived in a world where imagination was very active. And he understood these things to be the natural expression of the divine touching his life. There are occasional individuals, perhaps rare individuals, but I've met a few, who sometime in their very early childhood, right at what I think is the verge of the beginning of individual consciousness, sometime in the age of 3 or 4, have a vision or a dream that marks their life. Jung had such an event when he was in that age, 3 or 4. He had a dream in which he went into a subterranean chamber and there saw something very much like a deity. It looked rather like a snake, except it only had one eye. It came across him as extremely numinous. He describes it as ithyphalic, and what that means, I'll let you go home and look up. That was it. A powerful event, an image. 3, 4 years of age. In those early years, his life was marked by other such things. He lived in the country, and to him, there was a magic. I don't know if any of you have lived in what we might call primitive societies, agricultural societies, societies a bit removed from our sophistication as city folk. But you know there's a natural magic that those who live close to the land feel. They see, they sense. They sometimes are troubled by what we call superstitions because it's part of their experience of the world. Strange things happen. Well, Jung found that a natural part of his world. He felt that there was actually a spirit moving in things and moving in him. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he spends many pages talking about these, but there's only one vision I'll tell you about that came during those years. When he was, I think, about 12, he was going to school in Basel. His family lived still out in the country, and he had a good long walk to school to make. And one day he came out from the school, walking by the cathedral. And a thought came to him, a beginning of a thought came to him. He saw the blue sky. He saw the wonder of the sun and nature shining tiles of the cathedral roof. And he thought, and there is the beauty. There is God in heaven. There is the cathedral. And then a terror came over him. He couldn't finish the thought. Something seemed about to break through. And it troubled him. He went home troubled. His mother saw him and asked him, had something happened at school? And he said, no, it's something else. And he thought about it. I'm trying to think something. I'm trying to see something. But I don't want to. I'm afraid to. And he thought, what is God doing to me? Why is this will, other than my own will, imposing itself to me, giving me a thought, trying to make me think a thought I don't want to think? What is that? He pondered this for days and days. The thought was there. The the sky, the cathedral, God in his throne. He felt he was on the verge of some sort of a realization, but he was afraid of it. And then he thought, well, let's see. Because you remember, he's the son of a parson. See, God created the world, didn't he? And he put Adam and Eve in the garden. He made them, didn't he? And he made a snake. And he made the snake before he made them, didn't he? And he put them all in the garden together with some purpose. And so they did something. And he didn't like it. But it wouldn't have happened if he wouldn't have set the situation up so it could happen. Anyway, he must have really intended it to happen. I mean, it was his creation. They were his. It seemed his story. Maybe even things we seem wrong, things we don't want to happen, nonetheless, God is willing them on us. And maybe what we need is the courage to face them. The courage to face that will other than our own imposing itself. And so with great courage, he thought perhaps he just needed to let this thing happen. So he walked out in the street. The sky was blue. The sun was shining. There was the Cathedral of Basel, which he loved, a beautiful structure. And there above was God on his throne. And then he saw a great, what he describes in his Swiss German as turd, fall from underneath the throne of God, descend down, land upon and shatter the Cathedral of Basel. Okay, he thought, I've done it. Now I am damned. I have thought the unthinkable thought. How could I think such a vile thing? Well, a divine will had imposed itself upon him. I didn't want to think that. It was forced upon me. I had the courage. I faced it. And he felt, in a way, that perhaps he had stepped at that point beyond redemption. But he also felt that he'd also had the courage to face up to the will of God, rather like Adam and Eve thrown from the garden. Throughout these years, Jung started developing a sense of a dual personality within himself. And again, understand here, I'm just telling you his story. This is the story he tells us. Take it as you will. He started sensing a dual personality. A number one, he called them, and a number two. Now, this is an experience I know some of you have had sometime in your life, a sense that you are two different things. One very, very, very old, and one, you, just you, child you, stupid you, wise you, sick and tired you, happy you. But then there's something else. Now this, it's an experience that I've seen expressed sometimes in the terms a old soul. I've met children, as I think perhaps you have, or maybe you've been such a child, who really seemed just that there was something in them that was way beyond them, something much older, something much different, something that really went further back in time than even time could count. And yet, nonetheless, there was this other personality, which was just them. Jung intensely had this experience. And he actually developed these names of the number one, the number two. The number one, him. The number two was a wise, old presence, an old man, that seemed to be standing back well beyond his own time, the time of the late 19th and early 20th century. Well, these experiences that Jung had, the impositions of the divine will, he really wanted to find some indication that others were having the same things. He was feeling extremely isolated in his being. So his father was a pastor, and there was theology and all this God talk, so he went looking in theology for evidence of others who had experienced God as he experienced him. And what he found in the theology of his time was a dry rationalism. To him, all of the theology, the stuff that he got from his own father and from the books seemed like some sort of a dry rationalization of individuals trying to prove to themselves through ratiocination that God existed, that all this Christian dogma was true. Jung didn't need that. He didn't need somebody to prove it to him rationally. He knew it experientially. What he wanted to find is some evidence that others were sharing that experience, that they too had had that experience. And he looked in vain. He became, in a sense, very isolated in that experience. It became his secret domain, and he knew really that he could not share it with anybody. He could not talk about it because it would not be understood. And I suspect that there are some here who have had an inkling of a similar experience. I found many who shared it in ways that they could not really explain. And as happens in later adolescent years, when we emerge from the closure of our own worlds into the social realm that demands things of us, Jung progressed more and more into that number one figure, his self. He was a curious fellow, curious about natural sciences, history, philosophy. In fact, he was curious about just about everything and couldn't figure out one thing that interested him the most. Eventually, he fell as he left his high school years and entered university upon the course of the study of medicine. And he did very well. In fact, he graduated in the top of his class. Many paths were open to him at that time because he had done well and because of his obvious brilliance. He was offered a variety of positions. As he was studying for his final exams of medical school, he decided that it was really time for him to look at the one subject that he had really not paid any attention to. The subject that, well, it wasn't thought very highly of by the science of the late 19th century medical establishment. And it was a new fangled type of foolishness called psychiatry. And so he took home a textbook of psychiatry and read the introduction, with the question in his mind, well, let's see what these psychiatrists, what psychology has to say for itself. And in the introduction, he came across this description of psychology. It was described as a study of the diseases of the personality. And something just erupted in the mind of Jung at that moment. He had been studying diseases of the physical, diseases of tissues, diseases of blood, diseases of bone, infectious diseases. And all of a sudden, he realized that there might be another path. What had interested him, really, were the functions and malfunctions, perhaps his own malfunction in the soul realm, the psychic realm, the realm of the personhood. Was there a medical science of the person, of the experience of the person, of the diseases, the transformations, the malformations of personhood? And was there a curing of those diseases? A curing. Because you see, that's what medicine's about. It's not just about understanding disease and process of disease. It's about understanding disease and process of disease so that we might find a cure. And he decided at that moment that there was only one path for him, and that was the road of psychology, psychiatry. And so he entered in to study in Zurich at an institution called the Bergholtzi. At this particular time, when one undertook what was known as a residency, postgraduate training in medicine, it was really a residency. You moved in, and Jung moved in to the insane asylum. The Bergholtzi, outside of Zurich, and lived there, I think, for about 7 years. In this particular environment, when one moved in, one became a resident studying the specialty, it was expected that you would spend pretty much your entire day with your patients. And that's what he did. Day after day, in great detail, he entered into the world of the insane, some incurably, some simply neurotically, some there with minor problems, some there for life. And he listened, and that was what was expected. And he took notes, and he heard what diseases of the soul had to say for themselves. This was the year 1900 or so. Around the same time, something else was happening in this new science of psychology, psychiatry. There was a fellow, what was his name? Oh, let's see, Sigmund Freud, yeah. And he had written a book called The Interpretation of Dreams. A radical, strange vision it was. He also was looking at diseases of the soul, psyche, and had come through his own analysis of himself, of his neurotic milieu in Vienna, to the conclusion that, indeed, these illnesses, these disorders, could really be explained. There was a thing called the unconscious. It was like a cellar, a basement. And through a variety of processes in this vector, linear material vector of our lives, we encountered traumas, bumps on the road. We encountered garbage, problems with potty training and such, sexual things. We won't talk about those. They're nasty. And he put them into the cellar. You know, we put them in the cellar because they were just that. They were nasty. We really didn't want to talk about them. They were disturbing, traumatic. But out of the cellar, they came dancing at times, wearing the strangest of costumes, causing the most riotous disturbance in our lives, disorders, diseases. Well, Freud was a big name, but one that was much belittled in academic science. Freud had some problems. First amongst them, he was a Jew. Germanic culture at this time, that was a bit of a problem. Not only that, most of his followers in Vienna were Jewish, and most of his patients were also. Around 1901 or so, Jung first read Interpretation of Dreams and didn't respond too strongly. But after several years living as a resident in the insane asylum, he had started to develop some of his own theories. He developed one test, which actually we still deal with, the association experiments. You know, you throw out a word and see what the spontaneous associations are. He developed this entire idea, this type of testing, was his research development at the Bergholzi during those years, 1902, 1903. And Jung himself was becoming prominent. He was publishing. And then he again crossed roads with Freud. They didn't really meet until 1906. But then came a association of about 6 years, which was really phenomenal. When they first got together in Vienna and talked, for their first meeting, it is said that they actually sat down after lunch and talked throughout the whole night. They talked solidly for 14 hours. There was a real meeting of the minds. And of course, Freud saw in Jung something more than just a disciple. Freud saw in Jung, well, an intelligent, non-Viennese, and non-Jewish supporter, a man of science who was willing to come to his side. Now, this was important. It was important, as Freud saw, for his psychology, for it ever to be accepted outside of the very narrow circle, for it ever to be less belittled, more than the less it was taken for, shall we say. Within a few years, probably by 1910, Freud had made of Jung the crown prince of the psychoanalytic movement, the successor he was seen to be of Freud. He became the president of the Psychoanalytic Association. Papers were published. This was one of those periods of absolute intellectual explosion, when an idea meets the right moment, the right time, takes root, and wham, 4, 5, 6 years. Well, there was a problem, though. A problem of visions. A problem of vision. During this period, Jung had a dream. It was a dream of a home. It seemed his home. In the dream, he was on the second floor of what seemed a very prominent residence. Well decorated in a Rococo style, he describes it. And he looked around the house. There was fine art on the walls, and nice carpets, good furniture. And he thought, my house, not bad. And then he saw there was a stairway. And so he thought, well, I think I ought to look around this place a bit. Went down the stairs to the next floor down. And there the atmosphere changed. As he got into the house there, it seemed medieval. It had brick floors. The atmosphere was Romanesque. Now he was really interested. Now this is an interesting house. And then he saw there was another stairway. Sort of dingy and dark and old. And he went down it. All of a sudden, this house on its third layer had something that seemed... he said he looked at the walls and he saw that they were stone mixed with brick mixed in the mortar. This is a construction style characteristic of the Romans. It was Roman, very old. And then he saw something more. There on the floor, there was a trap door with an old steel ring. Now this is getting interesting. He picked up the trap door, pulled the stone apart, and there was the tunnel that kept going down. And down he went. And there he found himself in what seemed a Stone Age cave. And there on the floor were two skulls, very old, archaic remnants. What a dream. And that dream struck him and left him pondering. Oh, he told it to Freud, and Freud suggested that what this really represented was a death instinct between two people. And so Freud wanted to know who were the two people that Jung wanted to be dead. And that was the Freudian interpretation of that dream. Jung couldn't accept that. This dream had something else to say. Indeed, it had something to say about Jung's own view of the unconscious and the view of Sigmund Freud. You see, the nature of Freudian psychology was to see the unconscious as a bucket with a bottom, or as a cellar with a solid single floor. Okay? We lived in the materialistic view of Freud, a view common to the late 19th century and all too damn common in the early 21st century. We lived on one plane, you see, a material plane. Spirits, no. History was a vector. It had its bumps, its twirls. And if there was anything in the unconscious, it was there because from that linear, planar experience of life, we had taken the detritus, the trash, the problems, and thrown them into that cellar. What was in the cellar came from the experience on the first floor. We just dropped it down there. Oh, yeah, it came back. And we didn't drop it down there willfully. I mean, there were protective mechanisms, ways in which we were repressed and forced by our nasty parents to put it in there. Well, parents can be pretty nasty. They can be a problem. We all know it. And some of us are parents and know it from that perspective as well. But so it was. It got put in there. But you see, Jung's perspective upon the unconscious was opening up. It was starting to show the floor to have trap doors. It kept going down and down and down. Jung, during this period, 1910, 1911, 1912, started intensely studying mythologies. He found in these old stories, in history, images, archetypes, shall we say, primitive forms that seemed to be quite independently reproduced in the psychological material coming forth, both in his own dreams and in the dreams and visions and delusions of the insane folk that he dealt with, the crazy people. And we all are crazy people to some degree. Finally, there came a confrontation with Freud, an event that really signaled the beginning of Jung's understanding of what it was that was dividing them, that was making them different.